Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, 600 economists, including seven Nobel laureates, signed a letter urging lawmakers to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. During his State of the Union address, President Obama announced that he will use his executive authority to raise the wage to $10.10 for future federal contract workers. The intensified national debate on the rise in income inequality and the plight of low-wage workers has also given a boost to calls for a higher wage. And polls show that both Republicans and Democrats support an increase. A recent Gallup poll found that 76% of those surveyed, including more than half of Republicans, back an increase. And several states and cities have passed their own wage laws. Last September, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill to raise the state's minimum wage from $8 an hour to $9 an hour by July 1st and to $10 an hour in 2016. Ron Unz, a Silicon Valley multimillionaire, is hoping to put a measure on the November ballot that would raise the wage to $12 an hour by 2016. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the minimum wage. What would an increase mean for the 28 million people making minimum wage? How would it affect the economy? How do you think the wage should be set? And how does this relate to a living wage? And how does this vary across the country? The White House's 2013 fact sheet on increasing the minimum wage cited a study by our guest Bill Lester and his colleagues. They did a paper comparing employment growth across states. Bill Lester is an assistant professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. Bill specializes in economic development and the impact of living wage policies on urban economic development, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for coming in. We're also joined by Michael Konzel, a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, where he works on financial reform, unemployment, and inequality. His work has appeared in the American Prospect, Slate, and The Atlantic. And Michael joins us from the Monitor Studios in Washington. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So I want to start off with you, Bill. Right now, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. It hasn't been moved since 2009, and these calls would raise it to $10.10 an hour by 2016. One of the most fundamental issues is the effect this would have on employment. There's a lot of talk about that. So what does the data tell us about how this would affect employment?
Sure. Thank you for that question. Well, as you know, and as many of the listeners know, that the minimum wage is one of the most hotly researched and debated issues, both in the field of labor economics and nationally. And there's been a lot of research on this. But in our study, we really kind of came up with a very good, very sound study that looked at every time a state raised a minimum wage between 1990 and 2006. And we compared counties on one side of the state to the counties on the other side that didn't pass it. And so what we did is essentially a series of 318 case studies of the possible effect of the minimum wage. We found that wages went up significantly in response to the minimum wage, but employment basically stayed at zero or was just insignificant. So there's no disemployment effect. So that's what our study found.
Can you give us a specific example?
A specific example?
Yeah, like a town that raised the minimum wage and talk about what you looked at.
Well, in that paper, it was mostly states, state-level minimum wage.
So
we did include San Francisco, which during that time period did increase the minimum wage. So we treated San Francisco just like a state and compared San Francisco to the surrounding counties.
And so what did you find when you looked at San Francisco?
So when we looked at San Francisco, it was just, you know, one case study along with the rest of them, but we found that the wages went up and employment did not change. There was an earlier study done by my colleague, Aaron Dubay and Michael Reich and others that looked specifically before and after at fast restaurant chains in San Francisco and Alameda County and did a very careful analysis and found the same thing.
What would you say, because a lot of opponents would say, well, you're talking about a place like San Francisco. It's a thriving area, lots of jobs, people going out on a regular basis. But what would that look like in a small town?
Well, in the larger study, the national study, we did compare every state to change. So Illinois versus Indiana, New York versus Pennsylvania, every time there was any kind of discontinuity in the minimum wage. So that includes a lot of, higher wage places. It also includes a lot of sort of middle and low wage places. And so collectively, we found that all of those case studies, if you do them in the same study, the net effect is basically centered around zero and insignificant.
And Michael, what would you add to that? What does your research tell you? Because we often hear this from opponents, that this would cost a lot of jobs.
So I think there's kind of three arguments to understand why it might not cost a lot of jobs. And, Bill's research has been fantastic on this. The first is that a lot of the prices would just move on to customers. And, given that we have real disinflationary times, a small one-time bump in the cost of things like, fast food or, services would be good for the economy. Second is that, there's suddenly, if you have to pay your workers more, there's an incentive for managers to do a better job with their workers. So there might be better training. There might be better productivity on the floor. You might see institutional things that cause there to not really be the kind of employment drop that you'd expect. And the third is that a lot of these low-wage labor markets are really slack. So if you increase the minimum wage, you suddenly give people an incentive to go find these jobs, which means there'll be more people looking for jobs. And then there's also less of an incentive for there to be turnover, which, over time leads to more unemployment. So you might see the job markets tighten up a little bit. So to whatever extent that there could be a disemployment effect that could cause jobs, there's actually really sound economic reasons to believe that that might not be the case. And I think the research shows that those kinds of effects really predominate at the national level.
And have you done research looking at how this would affect, like a multi-million dollar corporation like a fast food chain versus the mom and pop shop on the corner?
I personally haven't done a study of like large corporate chains versus others. There is some research that was done on a series of fast food chains in the state of Georgia and Alabama, and they gathered payroll data, a study by Barry Hirsch and others, and they looked at the impact of the minimum wage and saw that workers did receive a raise from the minimum wage, but there was no disemployment effect. And they looked at another a number of sort of what they called channels of adjustment in that paper, and to explain like the points that Mike made about why we don't see this, why even large corporations could adjust to this kind of thing.
And Michael, what would you add to that?
Nothing particularly much. I mean, there's a lot of, as Mike said, there's a lot of different kind of channels under which you could have these adjustments. And, small local stores might have a more of a ability to kind of increase productivity, while larger firms might be able to pass it into other kinds of profits. So there's a wide variety of kind of mechanisms that would happen. But long story short is that when you put them all together, we don't expect minimum wages in the range we're talking about, like $10.10 an hour, to have a huge disemployment effect, or perhaps any disemployment effect at all.
And when you look at that, do you also factor in like the rise in rents, for example, in San Francisco, just basic necessities and how much that costs a business also? I mean, when you look at the rise in the minimum wage, because it seems like we separate the minimum wage from those other costs.
Well, in the research designs that we've been talking about, we're really trying to focus on the treatment effect itself. So we're trying to limit it to what's the effect of the wage increase and try to hold everything else constant. So what we're looking at employment before and after that particular wage change. You know, at that time, rents haven't changed along with it, or if they do, they change sort of across the control and the treatment group itself. So we're really trying to isolate the impact of the wage increase as opposed to sort of other things, other costs that are, probably staying the same or, maybe are high, such as rent. So we're trying to control for those under sort of confounding factors. But one of the things you can look at is what is the share of the total cost to a business of minimum wage labor versus other things like utilities, rent, like you pointed out. It's by no means 90% of their costs. There's other costs that go into, say, a restaurant producing a restaurant meal that are changing all the time, and restaurants are able to adapt.
And Michael, the debate we're hearing about minimum wage is so heated. I mean, every time you turn on the television, it's on. People are talking about the minimum wage. What strikes you about the debate you're hearing, and what are some of the myths that get repeated over and over again?
Well, one is the disemployment effect, as we just talked about. I mean, it's heated because, there's a lot of our economies at stake in this discussion. I mean, it goes to the heart of inequality. It goes to the heart of gender and employment. I mean, women are disproportionately minimum wage earners. I think it also goes to the future of the economy, because I think people are nervous that a lot more of the future of the economy will involve service employment, will involve low-skill work. And, you know, it's a question about whether or not these jobs will both be able to support a family, whether or not you'll have to live in poverty, even if you're working full-time. And they also go to a more bigger issue about dignity in the workforce. I mean, you know, you see a minimum wage really gives workers a more power over their employment, more power over their bargaining, and it's a way of help boost the employment. What I do find interesting is watching what people propose as an alternative to things like the minimum wage. I think on the right, sometimes you'll see people say we need to do other things like income support, the earned income tax credit, for instance, or, you know, other ways. And then you kind of watch whether or not they really mean it, whether or not they're really talking serious numbers about it. And, you know, I think those are kind of, you know, I think it goes to such a fundamental part of our weak economy right now that it does not surprise me that it gets people very energized.
What are your thoughts on that, Bill?
Sure. I mean, I think it's an important issue because if you think sort of a broad view, over the past, say, 30 or 40 years, what we've seen in the labor market generally is a pattern of sort of bipolarization, where you have growth at the very high end and growth in what are really non-tradable service sector jobs. These are jobs that can't be outsourced, right, that have to be produced face-to-face, things like restaurants, things like retail. And those have always sort of been lower wage jobs. And the question, and when we're considering something like the minimum wage, is, you know, what kind of economy do we want to have? And what tools can we use to reshape and redefine or redescribe what, you know, job quality is like in those particular sectors? And so minimum wage is one tool. Other, you know, unionization is what reshaped the manufacturing sector, you know, throughout the 20th century. So, you know, this discussion is not surprising, given that long-term trend of polarization in the labor market.
And Michael, can you put a face on this? Again, we're talking about almost 28 million workers. The average age is 35, mostly women. Today's minimum wage earns a full-time worker with $290 for a 40-hour week. That's about $15,080 per year. So can you talk about how this would actually affect people if the wage increases to $10.10 an hour?
Well, I think it's important to have a really strong description of who the people we're talking about. If you actually look at all the people who make under $10.10 an hour, and then there's also the minimum wage tends to impact people who make just slightly above the minimum wage, so if you look at that as well, you're not talking about teenagers from middle-class households who want some summer money or something like that, which is often what you'll hear in these discussions. You're talking about, on average, you're talking about a woman in her early 30s who has some college. You know, there's 28% of the people in this group will have at least one child. You're talking about a person who's working full time. So if you look at a family, for instance, if you're talking about one person with one or two children, you know, full time work at the current minimum wage will not bring you out of poverty. Mm-hmm. You're also talking about people with very erratic work schedules. You're talking about people who don't have a lot of power in their work, and so the minimum wage often kind of balances on those axes as well. But so you're talking about a group that is much more predominant and much more what we think of as people who do work, right? People who work full-time, people who are not teenagers but adults who need to sustain a family in their own lives. So I think it does have a much broader constituency than is often given credit.
Well, and even if the wage is increased to $10.10 an hour, for women, for example, who work full-time, they'll bring in a little less than $21,000 a year. I mean, it's how can you make ends meet on that, especially in a place like, you know, anywhere in California, really.
Right. I mean, that's a low amount, especially in a city like San Francisco, where the cost of living is so high. So certainly, you know, the minimum wage by itself is not a panacea. It's not going to fully solve that issue of polarization that I was talking about. But it does work. You know, there's some facts that, look, if you look at San Francisco's experience, which has been sort of a leader on not just the minimum wage, but a whole host of local labor market regulations, it has collectively been effective at addressing inequality, which is making sure that money is flowing to those at sort of the bottom quarter of the income distribution. And my colleagues Ken Jacobs and Michael Reich and Miranda Dietz came out with a new book recently that sort of looked at the whole impact of that sort of 10 to 15 year history of San Francisco, and they find that, you know, it was the changes resulted in $1.2 billion sort of flowing to low-wage workers that would not have taken place without that minimum wage, which locally here is adjusted for inflation each year. And so these are big differences. You know, San Francisco is a polarized city. It's high inequality. Mm-hmm. But those laws have had an effect. If you compare that to a place where I teach in Raleigh-Durham, the Research Triangle area, You can look at the data and wages and wage change, and that has not taken place. So, for example, fast food workers in San Francisco between 1996 and 2011, their wage growth was 30%. That compares to 17% wage growth in the average job in San Francisco. So those fast food workers, because of these laws, were actually sort of doing slightly better than the average. In Raleigh-Durham, Research Triangle Park area, that change was minus 0.2.
Wow.
So they basically no wage growth for fast food workers compared to about 8% wage growth for the average worker. So these tools can be effective.
Did you look at how it affected the lives of people in San Francisco? Do you have any anecdotes you can share?
I don't. My colleagues at Berkeley and other places have done these kinds of employee surveys. The Restaurant Opportunity Center has done excellent work on this, but I haven't myself.
Well, maybe our listeners have. But Michael, sure. Have you looked at that? So just personally, like personal stories from people who had their wages increased.
I've not analyzed it as a statistical matter. But you know, talking with groups that are right now in the streets protesting, the 15 in a union groups in Chicago and New York, you can see the real difference that a few bucks an hour would make in all these people's lives. I mean, you know, you're talking about stuff that's the difference between whether or not the gas goes on and whether or not, you know, when we think of poverty, you know, we think of it as a statistical matter, but it's also just a matter of whether or not you can make ends meet, you know, month to month. And the fact that you have a lot of people protesting, you know, taking a day or two, and a day or two's wages really makes a big difference for them, shows how urgently they want this to happen.
That is Michael Konzel. He's a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, where he works on financial reform, inequality, and unemployment. His work has appeared in many publications, including Slate, The Washington Monthly, and The Atlantic. And we're also joined by Bill Lester, assistant professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. He specializes on the impact of living wage policies on urban economic development. And on today's Your Call, we continue our agenda for a new economy series by talking about calls to raise the minimum wage. It has not changed since 2009, currently at $7.25 an hour. There are calls to raise it to $10.10 an hour. Almost 28 million people make minimum wage, mostly women in their early 30s with some college and at least one child. So what are your thoughts on raising the minimum wage? How should this wage be set? If you work for a minimum wage, we'd love to hear from you. If you've seen the wage change because of different laws, how has that affected you? Do you have employees who make minimum wage? And what do you think about calls to raise it? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Because there are so many critics out there, Bill, I mean, we were just talking earlier, the New York Times ran a piece on Monday about the fight over minimum wage illustrating the web of industry ties. So there's a lot of research groups out there. For example, the Employment Policies Institute is a widely quoted economic research center whose academic reports have been warning that increasing the minimum wage could actually be harmful, increase poverty, and of course increase unemployment. But it's rarely known that this group is funded by the Restaurant Association, according to the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, it's not surprising. Think tanks obviously get money from these groups, but they're getting a lot of attention.
Sure. I mean, I think something like the minimum wage is not that dissimilar from a lot of other sort of federal efforts to regulate the economy. And that whenever that happens, you can see corporate interests who might be affected have strong opinions and can mobilize resources to help put out their talking points. So I'm not surprised at that. I think if you've focus on the academic discussion, the literature, you know, and sort of abstract a little bit from that point. There still are legitimate debates over the minimum wage, and I think really careful research is going to be able to take that into account and say, well, why are these discrepancies? So you have one strand of research that says, okay, we run a national panel model. We're going to compare states with high minimum wages to low minimum wages, and let's see what happens. Those studies don't account for like spatial heterogeneity, or just the fact that some regions, broad regions like the Southwest or the South, have been growing faster than the Northeast and the Midwest or the Rust Belt for 30 years now. So if you don't take into account these regional trends, when you look at an industry like the restaurant industry, which really follows population, it's tied to where people live, you're going to get a sort of a biased impact. So what our study did was to control for these spatial differences, and that explains why we can reproduce those other results. But when you control for these the regional effects, the impact goes away. So I think just within the realm of the social science, there's that debate, but I think that debate is largely been addressed well by our paper and others that my colleagues have worked on.
And I should say that the Economic Policies Institute is run by a public relation firm that also represents the restaurant industry. And you can find this article in the New York Times at our website, yourcallradio.org. Michael, what are your thoughts on this? And just groups like this that are saying that the minimum wage increase would be harmful and actually increase poverty.
Well, I'm actually surprised at what broad popular support it has, given that it tends to mobilize industry against it. I mean, you're talking 70-80% of people. You're talking 50% of Republicans support a minimum wage increase. Given that industry itself is very opposed to it and has historically mobilized a lot of support, not just elite think tanks and kind of elite economic discourse, but also just, much more broad energies. It's still a very popular thing. I think anytime you interject in the economy, people get nervous about what's happening. But, the minimum wage has been with us since the 1930s. It's historically been much higher, and it's been much higher during the 60s and the 50s, mm-hmm. periods when you had real broad-based prosperity. So I think a lot of people look at it and say, in a bad case scenario, maybe it costs some jobs, but it also does deliver a lot of wages to people. It reduces poverty. We see this historically. So I think even in the bad case scenario, people are willing to understand that there's trade-offs, but there are trade-offs that are worthwhile to make. And then when you consider the leading evidence, which tends to say that the employment effects are minimal, if anything, then it seems like an even better deal.
Well, we've got a number of callers on this, so let's hear from Don in San Francisco. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for putting me on.
Sure.
I'm just calling in because I am a minority woman with some college. I'm an actress. And I had a job at a Mexican eatery in San Francisco, and it was a cashier job. It wasn't a server job, but we still did get tips. So I got minimum wage plus tips, and I stayed for much longer than I thought I would. I enjoyed it a lot, and I was really able to make ends meet and then some, and do a lot with that job. I was really shocked by it.
Hmm. So you were working in San Francisco after the wage was increased?
Yes, I was.
And so what are your thoughts on, how did that affect you, and what are your thoughts on calls to raise it to $10.10 an hour?
I just think, why would you not do it? It made me spend more money. I worked in Noe Valley, so I would walk past places like Sway and Ambiance, and I would spend money there, of course. I would literally have to ride my bike certain days, but I wouldn't spend the money that I had made, And so I think that it more than triggers the economy. And if it's women that are around 30 with some college that are making the money, they're going to want to spend it, I really like it, and we actually talked about it at my job. Like, it's nice to be working this job and be able to make ends meet and be able to still go out and have a life, go get noodles. I mean, nothing big, but just be able to go out and have a good time with your friends and still take care of business. And because I'm an actress, I am actually appearing in some shows and doing stuff with that, and I'm transitioning to a teaching job, and I literally wouldn't be able to do things like get headshots. That makes a difference. Mm. Get resume paper that's nice,
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Don. Sorry to cut you off, but we have to go to a break. Thanks for sharing your story. Today we are talking about calls to raise the minimum wage. How do you think it should be set? If you make minimum wage or you have made, we'd love to hear from you. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the number to call, toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'd love to hear from new voices. If you prefer to write rather than call, you can send your email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or if you prefer, you can just simply leave a comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about who owns California's coast. In 2008, Vinod Khosla, a billionaire venture capitalist, bought Martin's Beach, which is just south of Half Moon Bay, and he wants to block the public from accessing the beach. Surfers, fishermen, and beachgoers are fighting back. So we'll talk about what California law says about public access to beaches. And if you've seen a struggle over access where you live, we'd love to hear from you. And then on Thursday, we will continue our coverage on fracking in California. We'll talk about how much water is actually used, what bills have or have not passed at the state level, and what is really happening when it comes to fracking and an oil boom in California. That's Thursday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about calls to raise the minimum wage from the current $7.25 an hour, it hasn't been moved since 2009, to $10.10 an hour. There's so much debate on this issue, so what are your thoughts on it? How do you think the minimum wage should be set? If you're a business owner and you pay minimum wage, what are your thoughts on this? If you make or have made minimum wage, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, what strikes you about the debate? Because anytime you turn on, especially the cable shows, there's a lot of talk about minimum wage, and it's just getting so much attention in the media. So what are your thoughts on what you're hearing, especially from the opponents, because we're hearing from a lot of people who say that this is going to cost jobs and actually increase poverty. What do you want to know about the facts behind minimum wage? Today, we're joined by Bill Lester, an assistant professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's currently visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. Michael Konzel is a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, where he works on unemployment inequality and financial reform. And I wanted to ask you before we go to more callers, Don was talking about working at a fast food place in San Francisco. And Bill, can you talk a little bit about restaurant workers and how this would affect those who still get $2.13 an hour plus tips?
Well, you know, Don raised an excellent point there. So I was saying that Don raised an excellent point about getting the minimum wage in San Francisco, which is now, with inflation, $10.74 an hour, but then tips would be added on top of that. So California has that law. San Francisco has that law. That's relatively unique if you look throughout the United States. I think only it's about seven states that don't have what's called a tip exclusion. Other states say, we're going to say when the minimum wage goes up, our tipped minimum wage will go up by it, but it'll still be 40 or 50% of the actual minimum wage. So Illinois, it's around $4 for tipped workers. But in a lot of states, particularly in the South, like North Carolina, it's $2.13 an hour. And that was set back in 1991, and it has not been adjusted. So even when you point out the federal minimum wage change in 2009 and it changed in 1996, the tipped minimum wage did not change.
And so, it wouldn't with this one either in 2016?
You know, I haven't looked at the final version. I don't believe it is, but I could be wrong. I mean, I think there is a broad push now to raise that tip minimum wage. I believe it was during that compromise in 1996 between Clinton and Newt Gingrich to raise the minimum wage, one of the bargains was the restaurant lobby was able to sort of keep the tip minimum wage at $2.13 an hour.
Well, so this is really interesting because now that restaurant workers in San Francisco are making
The minimum wage is $10.74 January 1st.
Okay, so they're making $10.74 plus tips. And here in San Francisco, sometimes on our bills, we get the service fee. So if you get like a $40 dinner, you have to pay like $1.50 or $2. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of controversy over this for various reasons, and also what the restaurants actually do with that money. But did your data look specifically at restaurant workers and look at how restaurants were affected when these workers started making $10.74 an hour?
So our broad study of the minimum wage nationally was focused on mainly on the restaurant workers, and so we didn't look at those sort of price tag on add-ons separately, as one of the examples. In San Francisco, I've seen that on a lot of restaurants, and that has been responsive not just to the minimum wage, but there's a whole host of other labor standards here in San Francisco. The largest one was the healthcare security ordinance, which requires sort of a pay-or-play mandate. And so that was one way that some restaurants decided to sort of pass on that cost, because it adds an additional $1.80 or something around that per hour to each restaurant. So, it's a larger cost, so they're able to sort of pass it on, and consumers in San Francisco seem by and large, to be happy. And people still, the restaurants are still full in my neighborhood.
Yeah. So. Actually, they're fuller now
Right. Because
of the influx of people who live here.
But, you know, interestingly, so, you know, not all restaurants have gone that route. They've been able to adjust. And so it's interesting to see which ones do and which ones don't.
Right. All right. Well, thank you again for calling, Suzanne. Actually, our next caller, Suzanne in Concord. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So the question about how the minimum wage should be set, to me it seems like it would be a great thing if minimum wage was set to the average rent on a one-bedroom apartment in any given town or city. What do you guys think about that? I don't understand how minimum wages are set or how,
okay.
I don't understand the logic that says a minimum wage raise could create poverty.
Well, thank you. Michael, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So economists often agree that a minimum wage, usually what people look at is roughly half the median or average wage. So the average wage, I think, is about median wage is about $25 in the country. And so half that's about $12. That's often the range people talk about. And historically, that's often where it's been. You know, in terms of housing support and housing security, you kind of want to put your instruments best targeted where they can be, right? So minimum wage is very well targeted for low-wage work. You know, you don't want a minimum wage to be set because, you know, there's a lot of different housing markets. As I'm sure all your listeners know, the housing market in the Bay Area is so different than the housing market in, say, Kansas City or Texas. So, you know, there are other tools ranging from zoning to public housing to, you know, Section 8 to all kinds of other public support that can be used towards housing. But you kind of want your instruments to be very well targeted to the things that they can best accomplish. And the minimum wage is particularly good at income support for low-wage work.
Anything to add, Bill?
Sure. I mean, I think the idea of pegging it specifically to the price of a one-bedroom apartment would be sort of highly volatile. As people in San Francisco know, that's something that can move up and down very, very quickly. But you do, Suzanne, raise an interesting point about what's the sort of concept of the wage relative to you know, where we might want it. And so this idea of a living wage, which is different, is a different sort of policy tool compared to the minimum wage. When we talk about living wage policies, they're usually set with a local income calculator, which is what does it cost to live in this particular community above the poverty line? And that's where they do include differential housing costs. It's not the current marketable price for a one-bedroom apartment. It's the, you know, area median rent and set by HUD. So that's a different policy tool. It does take into account that issue of what does it really cost to live in this city and participate in the economy in a just way.
Because the living wage in right outside of Seattle in SeaTac, where the airport is, got national attention in November, and voters barely passed the $15 minimum wage slash living wage. Mm-hmm. The last I heard, a judge was going to rule on that. Do you have any updates on that?
I don't have any specific updates about that.
I don't think the judge actually has said anything on this. But they say that this could set a national tone because it was kind of, a lot of people were watching this.
Sure. After that came out, you saw other cities, Seattle itself, their city councils, considering maybe going to 15. Mayor Ed Lee here said there's maybe a push to go higher than the current minimum wage. So that kind of sparked a lot of interest in raising and sort of what's the bound politically that we can achieve. So it's interesting to see it sparked a lot of action at the city level. Maybe there's probably a dozen or so cities now considering a raise in the minimum wage.
Well, we've got a caller on living wage, so let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Of course, you know, where can you in the Bay Area live with minimum wage, even if it's $10 or even $15 an hour? What we're talking about is housing cost went about 40 times. $25,000 house I saw myself in 1968 in Craigmont and Santa Barbara Street of Spruce, you know, now selling for $1.5 million. Where the problem is, the overall economy is totally screwed up and a lot of fixing it has to be done. It all related to Wall Street. Everything was done as far as the voodoo economics of Reagan and all of them was to enrich the Wall Street. Meanwhile, the middle class of America vanished. 99% of the income in the last 10 years or so went to the 1%. What I like to, you know, finish the quote by saying that drastic measures have to be done. First, we have to bring all of this so-called outsourced jobs back. We have to put some sort of moratorium and a lot of imports, start making stuff in the country again. We have to put an end to the the phony HB1, HB2 visa, Mr. Microsoft idea of bringing talent from people. All of the talent come from this country, not from people. You fire an American making $300,000 to bring an East Indian making $20,000. That's all to save money. So big, the whole overhaul of the economy from Reagan time, which was totally destructive to this country, especially the middle class. Everything has to be done from the beginning.
Thank you for calling, Ede. Bill, what are your thoughts on this? There was an interesting report recently. I don't remember the magazine, but it was a progressive magazine that said there's too much focus on the minimum wage. That's not the solution to what we're dealing with right now. And with a lot of labor groups and unions putting so much focus on the minimum wage, it's not going to solve these problems.
Well, I mean, I think it does make some interesting points that, you know, this issue that I brought up earlier of the polarization of the American labor market is a long-term, very complex problem. You know, is it right to spend only our time talking about the minimum wage? Probably not. But what's interesting about it, it's sort of the proven tool we have, right? We've done research on it. We can figure it's effective at raising wages without causing major disemployment. We know how to use it. It's passed the legal test. It's not surprising that we want to do this because it's an immediate way to address the issue. Now, there are longer-term changes that need to happen, and I don't disagree, but they take a different coalition and a different dialogue. So it's not surprising that we sort of go first to the minimum wage, but just like solving any problem, you want to break it down to different pieces. And so I think the minimum wage is sort of an obvious place to start, but it's probably not the end.
What do you think, Michael?
I think we can all agree that our economy has huge challenges without necessarily figuring out everything that needs to be done. Minimum wage is going to be an essential part of it. I mean, we know that it combats inequality in the bottom half of the income. So it will help raise the wages of the lowest part of the income distribution. Now, by definition, that means the 1% and the top 1.1% or whatever, aren't necessarily impacted in that way. And that requires a whole other set of policy solutions, from financial reform to CEO pay to intellectual property and all kinds of other things. But crucially, I mean, there is no story in which we get to a more equitable and just economy that does not involve the minimum wage playing some role.
And again, it affects 28 million people.
Right. Right.
Mostly women, early 30s, as you said, some college, and at least one child. That is Michael Konzel. He's fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, where he works on unemployment and inequality. We're also joined by Bill Lester, assistant professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. And today we are talking about calls to raise the minimum wage from the current $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour. This is the federal minimum wage. So what are your thoughts on minimum wage? How do you think wages should be set in the United States? If you have made or make minimum wage, we'd love to hear from you. And if you pay minimum wage, what are your thoughts on this? Also, what do you think about the raging debate we're hearing in the media? A lot of different things are being repeated over and over again. What stands out for you? And what are some of the facts that you'd like to hear about? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Let's go next to Amir in San Francisco. Hi, Amir. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was hoping to bring up a point that I discussed in one of my sociology class when we were discussing the issue of wages and how they're set in the U.S. And we never really came to a decision, but I was hoping to pose a question to you guys. If there is a minimum wage set, why is there no maximum wage set? And what benefits do you guys see potentially from that kind of a reformation of the infrastructure? Because like you guys have been saying, there's been a lot of focus on the minimum wage being set and rehashing that issue. But I just don't think the issue has ever been brought upon us to, set a maximum wage and then a lot of the whole trickle-down effect that we've been hearing about in politics for the past decade might actually, work at least a little bit. So what do you guys think about that?
Well, thank you for calling. We actually did a show on this a couple of weeks ago, just shortly after, for the very first time in the United States, the top 10 American CEOs are now taking home over $100 million a year. What are your thoughts on this bill? I mean, we talked about, you know, whether or not you could cap CEO pay, and what would that look like in this country?
Well, I mean, there's the issue of capping CEO pay or trying to do some reform there, but then there's the sort of the broader issue if you had a maximum wage that applied everywhere throughout the economy. I think, yes, that would probably address inequality, but that's probably not the best way to intervene in the labor market. You still want that sort of allocative, efficient process of saying, you know, if somebody is, you know, very talented, and why shouldn't that sort of that worker be able to receive that wage? I think what you'd want to do is regulate essentially the aftermarket, right? So through the tax system, and say, look, when you can really, if you want to say that there's too much going up to that those particular earners, you know, use the tax system that way the rest of society can benefit from that revenue. So I think that's probably the best way to address it, rather than a maximum wage that would affect all workers. Because you think about it, okay, you know, technology workers are in the news a lot, but at least some of those the wages are flowing to workers rather than to just staying as profit in the corporation, right? So we'd probably want that to come into the income system, where it can go through the income tax, as opposed to stay as retained profit and stock prices and things like that.
And Michael, anything to add quickly on that one?
No, I think he covered the big parts there.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Amir. Jessica and Belinas couldn't stay on the phone, but she said the only reason people can live on minimum wage is that they get food stamps, so it's really not working. And there was a report that came out recently from economists at UC Berkeley and the University of Illinois that found that half of fast food workers in the U.S. rely on public aid.
Right, that's an amazing study by Sylvia Allegretto and Mark Dussard and others, and they found, I think it was $7 billion just in the fast food workers that could be saved if you were to raise the minimum wage for fast food workers. So these are workers working at big corporations like McDonald's or Burger King or other places that are paid such a low wage that they're eligible for things like food stamps and medical care subsidies. So if you were to raise their wages, essentially, the taxpayers could save up to $7 billion. I think I have that number correct.
Yeah, and this doesn't get mentioned much in this debate.
Well, I mean, it does in some places.
I guess I'm talking about national media
national
and the sound bites.
Yeah. In national media, I think that study is getting out there, and hopefully it will have a good life. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's one of the impulses for Mr. Unz's campaign to raise the minimum wage here in California is precisely that. I mean, here you have a conservative, wealthy individual who's putting this ballot initiative on, and it's part of it is to say, well, we don't want the government to be supporting all of these. We want the actual labor market to be producing these benefits. And so that's where you have sort of an interesting alliance between folks who are interested in supporting the minimum wage.
And again, that's Ron Unz. He's a Silicon Valley multimillionaire who wants to put a measure on the November ballot that would raise the minimum wage in California to $12 an hour in 2016, instead of the bill that was just signed by the governor that would raise it to $10 an hour in 2016. Michael, what are your thoughts on these strategies, taking something like this to the voters or doing it in the legislature?
Well, you know, a lot of that is very keen on California politics, and it's been some time since I've lived in San Francisco. So I think the voters, I mean, as you know, it's a broadly popular policy tool, the minimum wage. I mean, you see 70-80% of voters particularly support it, even a majority of Republicans often support it, depending on the poll. It's worthwhile, since we're talking a lot about poverty here, it's worthwhile to make the conservative case for a higher minimum wage, which is kind of Ron Unz's thing, which is partially it's an argument about government benefits, right? Whether or not we want businesses directly to support through wages, or whether or not we want taxes to do it. I think there's also a thing where, you know, the minimum wage is very, it's self-reinforcing. It doesn't have to be done through the tax code. The ITC and other ways we do income support are very powerful tools, but a lot of that money is doesn't go to people who need it, or it goes to fraud. There's a lot of implicit high marginal tax rates as a result of, you know, these benefits that flow. And by making these jobs more desirable, you might take some of the edge off undocumented workers. I mean, It's interesting how much conservatives do not make that case, but the ones who do actually make a pretty powerful case that I think brings in a lot of other people who aren't perhaps less concerned about, you know, a just distribution of wages or a living wage or whatnot. Mm.
But another argument that we see from opponents is that if you raise the minimum wage, it'll lead to more automation because employers either can't afford hiring more people or they don't want to pay a higher wage. Bill, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you look at the industries that are most affected by the minimum wage, the heaviest users of minimum wage labor, things like restaurants primarily, I think it's about 30% earn the minimum wage in the restaurant industry. I mean, that's not an industry where you can fully automate the process such that workers are taken out of the bargain. I mean, you still need someone there to cook a hamburger, to make French fries, and you still need someone there to serve it to you at your table. It's a very human interaction intensive industry, so it's very difficult to do that. If you look at the fast food industry, for example, I think they've already sort of mechanized the process as much as possible. So it's that argument that, oh, if we raise the minimum wage, we're just going to have more capital versus labor. I think their incentives are already there to do that, and there's not a whole lot of room to do that in that particular industry. If you look at some of the other industries that use the minimum wage quite a bit, the same thing is true. I mean, that might be the case with something like manufacturing, but if you look at the wages in manufacturing, mostly they're above the minimum wage.
Michael, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's right. I think we're quite some time away from a robot waiter serving you your dinner and your entree. That's a kind of humorous thing to think about. You know, in so much as that it will cause firms to invest in productivity for workers, that means that there's going to be less of a disemployment effect. And that could be, in general, a beneficial thing to our economy. I mean, it might involve in more innovation, more productivity from low-wage workers, and in general be a kind of a shadow boom for our economy. So, I mean, there are stories in which that's not a big loss for our economy as a whole. And separately, as, you know, has been pointed out, you know, we haven't seen it so far, and it seems like that the marginal incentive is the technology is not there yet.
And also, this 10-10 calls to raise the minimum wage to 10-10 an hour, I mean, we're talking 2016, right? So this is 2 years from now. What does the data tell us about how this would actually affect the economy in 2016?
Well, I mean, in 2016, that 10-10 in today's dollars will be worth something less than $10 with just through inflation. So if you look at it by historical standards, that's actually not that large an increase. 1968 was the highest, and so that would barely get us to that level, but slightly under. If you also compare it to what's happened to where productivity has gone, total labor productivity, and Mike made an excellent point about there could be incentives about, you know, increasing productivity. Well, without something like the minimum wage or without a strong union movement, what is there to ensure that workers share in that productivity? We've seen labor productivity grow. If the minimum wage were to keep up with that productivity, it would be something like $18 an hour. Well, without sort of the political movement, it's hard to make sure that workers, particularly low-wage workers who have less power than others, to share in that productivity growth.
Well, we have an email from Denise in San Francisco who says, the way to get a decent wage is not to rely on government to provide minimum wage, but for workers to organize. At one time, San Francisco street cleaners, now classified as general laborers, got very low wages, but now that they're organized into the labor union, they earn almost $24 an hour, or almost $50,000 a year. Top salary after 5 years is $60,000 a year. Unionization for hotel workers, auto workers, steel workers, on down the line through our labor history, provided true living wages, not the minimum wage.
But I think she makes an excellent point. That's what I'm talking about, is how do you share in the productivity? You need something there, whether it's a minimum wage or probably more effectively a union to get you there. I think that's a story in San Francisco. If you look at the state of North Carolina, which is, I think, has the lowest union density in the country, around 2% of the private sector, that's a really difficult thing to do, especially overnight. While there have been some great success stories in certain plants in North Carolina, it's a right-to-work state. You need this sort of public intervention, in my belief, this is just my belief, to sort of help that along. Unfortunately, the politics in North Carolina probably looks a vast opposite to what it looks like in San Francisco. So it's important to remember there's a whole other country out there. One example of the impact of that is that the state legislature that just Republicans control, basically passed a law that outlawed cities from engaging in living wage laws. So the city of Durham several years ago had passed a basic contractor-only living wage law that said any company that wants to do business has to pay a living wage. The state sort of trumped that. Mm. And so we're engaged in a study right now with some of my colleagues to try and study the impact of that. And I think that'll be interesting to watch. But it's also interesting to sort of to remember the country looks very different outside of San Francisco.
Yes, that's right. Well, Michael, we have about a minute left. Where do you see this going?
As a quick note, isn't it ironic that conservatives, who usually are all about local control and federalism, are using states to block municipality actions, which I just find is hilarious. I actually think this does have momentum. I think it's a great political win for Democrats, so I think they're going to push it going into 2014. I think they're going to increasingly emphasize the gender components of it, which I think are crucial in understanding things like the war on women. And I think also, as you see in San Francisco and as you see elsewhere, it's the thing that can be picked up at the state and local level as well. So to whatever extent Congress can help catalyze the issue and perhaps even pass something, states and municipalities and ultimately low-wage workers themselves can step up and demand better reforms that will ultimately lead to a more just economy.
Do you think Congress can pass this given the political climate we're dealing with?
I don't know. I think President Obama's executive order is very helpful because I think it pushes a wrench forward, and now other businesses have to look at the fact that the federal government contractors might use the sufficiency wage to kind of bid up a lot of the high quality workers. I think the politics are as well aligned as anything. Even if it doesn't pass, it's something that will be in the background, like immigration reform, that will haunt the Republicans until some decision is ultimately made.
Michael Konzel is a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on these issues, inequality and unemployment. And Bill Lester is an assistant professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Who owns California's coast? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the California coastline and how it can be maintained as public space. In 2008, Vinod Khosla, a billionaire venture capitalist, bought Martin's Beach, which is just south of Half Moon Bay, and he wants to block public access. But surfers, fishermen, and beachgoers are fighting back. So what does the law say about public access to beaches in California? Have you seen struggles over coastal access where you live? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.